Welcome, I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Your Call. California state budget hearings are in process through mid-May. Governor Jerry Brown made headlines back in January with his budget proposal that supposedly brings California back into the black, partly due to the passage of Proposition 30 last November, which called for temporary taxes to fund education and other public services. So shouldn't we see this as a rising tide that lifts all boats? Well, the Greenlining Institute has a new report out that analyzes Governor Jerry Brown's proposed budget from the perspective of its impact on communities of color, and they're calling it pretty much a mixed bag of good, bad, and ugly. Using this racial equity frame to break down the budget plan in the categories of health and social services, health care, and education, these researchers found Latinos are expected to feel the most pain from Brown's budget. And while the budgetary reserve is projected to be $1 billion by the end of 2013-2014, according to the report, 16.6% of Californians will still live below the poverty line, with the American Indian and Alaska Native American, African American, and Hispanic or Latino populations having the highest poverty rates still. So how exactly will the proposed budget affect communities of color? And what do you think of measuring the state budget through this lens of racial equity? Could it create a more just society? So with us here today to discuss are the authors, editors of the Greenlining Report. Michelle Romero is the Claiming Our Democracy Program Director at the Greenlining Institute. And the Greenlining Institute is a policy research and advocacy organization that works for racial and economic equity. In her role, Michelle directs the Greenlining Institute's voting rights and election policy work, and her program serves as the hub for California legislative efforts. Recently, she worked on this project that analyzes the budget through the lens of California's diverse majority, and Michelle joins us in studio. Thank you, Michelle, for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm happy to join you.
Absolutely. And also with us is Justin Rauza. He's the Health Program Manager for Greenlining's Bridges to Health team at the Greenlining Institute. And he focuses on equitable implementation of the Affordable Care Act and developing innovative policies that reduce health inequities. He says he's driven by a passion to eliminate health inequities through prevention, relationship building, and pursuing public health opportunities in historically non-public health sectors like finance, education, land use planning. And Justin says he firmly believes that all people should have an opportunity to thrive. Justin also joins me in studio. Hey, Justin.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here today.
Well, thank you both for being here. So let's kind of get straight into it. Michelle, you were one of the editors of this report, and this idea of okay, here's the budget. Here's Governor Brown's budget. As I said in the intro, you know, many people cheered and hailed and, you know, yay was going all around. But you're saying, wait a minute, we need to look at this from a certain lens, through the lens of the racial equity kind of frame, to see what it really means for the people of California. So, like, what prompted you to even think about this and to start this idea of analyzing in this different way?
So, you know, Greenlining Institute really believes that every American deserves a fair shot at the American dream, and that just isn't a reality. And so we constantly are looking at policies through this racial equity lens. So let me tell you what I mean by that. You know, equity is not the same as equality. Equality really emphasizes the inputs, right? That everybody gets the same thing. So if you think about this in a patient-doctor relationship, if a doctor treated all of its patients the same and gave everybody antibiotics, regardless of what condition they had, some may be treated, right? Those that had an ear infection or something where an antibiotic could treat it. Those that came in with a broken arm or a severe burn or a back injury, for example, wouldn't be affected by that treatment. So although all the patients would receive an equal treatment or an equal allocation of an antibiotic, it wouldn't necessarily affect them the same. And that's true of our budget, and that's true of a lot of our policies. And so what we need to emphasize, especially at a time like now, where, you know, California has been a diverse majority state for a while, but we're going to see the Latino population surpass any other ethnic group this year. And Asian Americans in especially the San Francisco Bay Area are an even faster growing population. We have to make sure then that our priorities are looking at the issues from an equity lens. So equity, unlike equality, values more the output or the outcome. Right. It would, in our example of this doctor-patient relationship, emphasize that everyone gets what they need. Right. So if someone came in with a back injury, they might be referred to a chiropractic doctor. If someone came in with a broken arm, they would need a cast. Right. And so while there may be a difference in the input, whether it's time, money, or competency, or another resource, everyone basically leaves with a fair outcome, you know, and can live healthy, happy, prosperous lives. And so that's really what this is about.
So the treatment is tailored to the patient.
It's tailored to the patient, exactly.
So what do you mean by diverse majority when you say diverse majority?
Yeah, well, Asians, Blacks, and Latinos collectively comprise more than 60% of the state's population, right? There is no single ethnic group that comprises 50% or more. We're really a diverse state. And so the needs are different. Like you mentioned, you know, and what we found in our report, 16% of the general population lives in poverty, but one in every four African-Americans or Latinos are in poverty. And so the needs are different. And as our demographics change, we need to be sensitive to that. Other things, you know, like language access may affect these diverse communities, whereas they didn't in previous years.
And let's stay on that demographic question a little bit. When I was reading through this, vulnerable communities came up a lot, vulnerable communities. So I'm wondering who we're talking about. When you created this report, who were you talking about in your mind? Because vulnerable communities, is it, you know, just communities of color? Is it economically disadvantaged people? Because that would include white people in the right. lower income brackets. So who do you mean?
Right. For us, and Justin might join in here and have something else to say, but what we're looking at through our racial equity lens is the intersection of some of these things, right? Race and income, for example. And language proficiency is sort of another layer, right? And so it depends on what the policy issue is that we're talking about. I think healthcare reform and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act presents some unique challenges there. And so there's a lot of choices that we can make with our budgets to make sure that we're going to be reaching all of those different communities.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have one overall definition of, so you're saying we're dealing with these intersections, so
right.
it's going to be different people that we're talking about at different points in the report.
Absolutely. You know, and we're really looking at low income folks of color. And I think if you look at a lot of these issues through a purely economic lens and looking at income categories, you're going to see a lot of disparities. Right. If you look at it just through a racial lens, you'll see a lot of disparities as well. And so both are really relevant to a lot of the issues we'll be talking about.
All right. So who's seen this report so far? Who's using it? What have you heard kind of as reactions to it?
Yeah, you know, it's really amazing we hadn't done this sooner. like I said, you know, we look at policy through this lens all the time, and the budget being one of our biggest policies that we pass each year, and we hadn't really done this report for the public before. We launched the briefing and the report in Sacramento at a convening with department agencies, legislators, and their staff, and community advocates.
Of Health and Human Services?
Correct. And mm-hmm. Department of Education and some of those stakeholders that are concerned about the issues like Health and Human Services and education that we covered in the report. And so, we are hearing good feedback from offices that are using it. A lot of the new freshman legislators who are coming into this experience and for the first time, you know, dealing with the budget conversations and negotiations and are able to now have this new tool of a racial equity lens to think about how it might affect their constituents.
So have they been saying this is a perspective that we haven't been discussing, you know, in the Capitol or, you know, in Sacramento?
Absolutely.
They
yeah.
have not.
They have not. I mean, I think a lot of folks do great work around the budget. California Budget Project's one of them, right? They produce reports and tools throughout the year on the budget that get at the income issue. And so they do talk about income inequality and how certain aspects of the budget will affect low-income folks. They don't look at it with this intersection of race. And I think that, you know, we have a real problem in this state that we're afraid to talk about race. But by not talking about it, it doesn't make the problems go away, right? So we need to think about that, especially with the way the demographics are shifting. Because if we're not investing smartly in a way that is equitable for all communities and that serves those communities, it's not just bad for those families and for those communities. It's bad for all of us. That is our economy. That is our state.
Right. All right. So let's start talking about kind of what you found. First, like going into this, Justin, let's go to you. What did you expect to find? That's something that would be interesting to see kind of, were you expecting to find deeply entrenched problems that would, you know, that are not discussed? Were you expecting to find all good news, all bad news? What were your expectations and what did you find?
That's a great question. Our expectations, we tried to limit them. We really wanted to give Governor Brown's budget proposal a fair chance. And however, we did realize that because of both the national economic recession and our state's budget deficit, that there were likely going to be a lot of holes in the health safety net that haven't been filled at this point and have been suffering significant cuts in previous years. And so we just approached it. We looked at the numbers. We looked at staffing levels. We looked at other reports to do our analysis through this racial equity lens. And our expectations, we tried to limit to give it a fair shot.
Okay. And were you surprised?
We were surprised in certain ways. We were surprised that, in a good way, that the governor has proposed to expand Medi-Cal, Medi-Cal expansion, which is optional under the Affordable Care Act, so states aren't actually required to do so, but he's chosen to move forward that, and so that was a good surprise. Some of the surprises that were on the opposite end of the spectrum, for instance, were the cuts to the Department of Social Services in terms of funding levels for CalWORKs or for child care. Those were some of the most significant cuts that have been made since 2008. Mm-hmm. And while he's not making further cuts this year, the cumulative impact of all the cuts from these previous years are massive. So, for instance, with state-subsidized child care, since 2008, essentially $1 billion has been cut, which translates into 110,000 childcare slots. So that's, you know, 110,000 low-income children. And I did the math. That's enough to fill AT&T Park 2.5 times. Hmm. And the people that use these childcare slots, sometimes the stereotype or the myth is that they're unemployed and they're using the childcare to help them through that process. Well, our analysis found that it's actually the converse is true. 77% of the people utilizing childcare are employed. Hmm. And also 3/4 of these children are Hispanic or Black. And so if we're talking about our changing demographics in the state, how is cutting childcare really going to help the employment of these groups? Because now either they have less money because they have to spend it on more expensive childcare, mm-hmm. or they're not able to access the quality jobs that they can because they have to work odd hours in order to take care of their children because they are accessing these services. And so those are some of the major things that we pulled out from at least the health side of our analysis.
And we'll talk about the education side a little bit later on in the show. So you chose to focus on health and social services, K through 12 education, and higher education. What made you choose those categories in particular to focus on rather than other things?
Yeah, well, I mean, health and human services, I think, was obvious, right? There's a lot of opportunity and choices that are going to be made now with healthcare reform. And so we want to make sure then that through the implementation and in a proactive way, right, at the onset of this implementation, we're making choices that are going to be equitable. And then K-12 and higher education continue to suffer from budget cuts, and it's a constant issue. And so for our communities, I think we really see that as a wealth-building opportunity. Education can be a pathway out of poverty, and so we want to make sure that we're protecting that pathway.
It's also a matter of what we could actually say. In our initial analysis, we did look at some of the impacts on the criminal justice system, but there were so many variables that we couldn't say anything conclusive, so we couldn't include it necessarily in the report. Mm. So we did look at a much broader spectrum, but we only included things that we could actually provide an actual analysis on.
That you could actually measure.
Right.
So what are the positives that you found? What's the good news out of this report?
Yeah, you know, I think that some of the changes to K-12 funding present some of the most positive opportunities. There's some in the healthcare area as well, but the changes to how we're going to fund K-12 education could mean that lower income school districts are actually receiving more dollars under a new, what they call, local control funding formula than previously under our current funding formula. And so with that, I mean, we could see a lot of innovation around at the local level. And so these dollars come with more flexibility for local governments to and local districts to spend the dollars mm-hmm. to address the population's issues. But yeah, I think if we can, so two things, right? One is there money going into those areas being invested? The other issue is going to be how it's spent. But I think there's a lot of positive opportunity around that. And then we have some serious concerns in higher education, actually.
Even with the passing of Prop 30?
Even with the passing of Prop 30. And I think, you bring that up. There was a lot of positive encouragement or optimism that Prop 30 was going to solve all of our problems.
Hey, our neighborhood was out in the street and, you know, just cheering. And
oh, yeah. Everyone was Governor Brown's biggest fan, holding signs for Prop 30. And I think, you know, it was needed, right? It was needed. But we have this money now. And so, again, it's about the second question, which is how are we spending it? So two things. One I'll bring up is, you know, with the passage of Prop 30, there's now an opportunity for the UCs and the CSU systems to receive more funding. How Governor Brown has proposed to give those funds to those two entities is in an equal way. Mm. So both segments of the of higher education, the CSU system and the UC system, will receive an equal allocation of about $125 million more. Now, that's a lot. But when we're looking at it, we're thinking about equity, right? So in terms of diversity, there's a lot more racial diversity and students of color in California State University schools than there are in UCs. And the CSU system serves about twice as many just students, right, in pure numbers sense. So then what does that mean? That means every CSU student, if you think about it in a per pupil way, receives $242 less than every UC student. Now, you know, there's some other factors that play into this.
How do you factor that? Can you kind of break that down?
Yeah. So, you know, the California State University, it's going to get $125 million, roughly. It enrolls more than 412,000 students. So if you break down that $125 million per student that is enrolled, each California State Student University student gets about $303. Now, that money's not actually coming to the student's pocket, but it's going to services that are going to serve that student at that institution, right? At the UC system, same amount of money going in. That's the equality model, right? Different number of students served, about 229,000. So about half as the CSU. And so then they are going to be seeing about $546 per student. Tuition levels are different, right? So that's a consideration, of course. The other question to ask, I think, is what is the median household income for a student enrolled in UC compared to a student enrolled in CSU? I think when you think about, you know, the percentage of that dollar coming out of that household income, you know, there's a lot of factors there to consider. And so equality is not necessarily the same thing as equity. And those are the kinds of questions we want to be asking ourselves.
Do you think that philosophy of equity versus equality is going to fly in Sacramento? And are they going to take it? Is it going to work?
You know, I think that if they're smart, they'll take it, right? Senator Ricardo Lara, who spoke at our budget hearing, said, you know, the budget is a reflection of our priorities. And if this state cares about providing fair opportunities in education, in healthcare, and in all these areas for communities to prosper, then they have to care about equity. Not just equality, right? Both are important, but they have to think about equity.
And we're starting to see some of that happening in the legislature. It may not be explicit in terms of the equity lens, but for instance, one of the bills moving through the legislature right now is AB 411. And the author for that is Assemblymember Pan, who represents Sacramento. And essentially, this bill is now trying to look, is requesting to look at racial and language data from the Medi-Cal program, which currently isn't used, but he's trying to use these measures so that the program can become more efficient, can improve itself by using racial and economic data as well. So while it's not necessarily branded as equity, I feel like, especially from the health side of the legislature, there are some movements towards this direction because we do see healthcare costs are spiraling out of control. So what we're doing is not working. So we're trying to push forward this equity lens to better address the issues.
And we'll talk about Medi-Cal in a little bit. I'd like to invite the listeners, if you have a question or comment for our guests, or if you'd like to weigh in on looking at the California budget through the lens of communities of color, give us a call, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Again, that's feedback@yourcallradio.org. With me is Michelle Romero and Justin Rauza of the Greenlining Institute, who just issued a report, and they're looking at the California budget through the lens of communities of color. And we're continuing to talk with them. We will take a short break and be back with you here on KALW. And we will again await your calls at 866-798-TALK and your emails at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio KALW. If you feel you have a perspective that hasn't been heard in today's discussion, please join us, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Programming on KALW is supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. In celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Sedaris will visit San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House Sunday, May 5th, for an evening of all new readings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's happening next. Well, tomorrow we'll be talking about plastic manufacturers. Should they be held responsible for plastic pollution? What would corporate responsibility look like for plastics and the packaging industry in your eyes? Friday is our weekly media roundtable where we speak with journalists about the week's news coverage. On Monday, we're going to ask the question, what happens when people speak truth to power? We'll highlight two films from the Human Rights Festival and USF. And today we're talking about the Greenlining Institute's new report that analyzes California Governor Jerry Brown's proposed budget from the perspective of its impact on communities of color. Latinos are expected to feel the most pain from this budget, but they're calling it a mixed bag. There's some good, there's some bad. And so the question today is, how will the budget affect communities of color? And joining me are two editors of this report. Michelle Romero, she is a policy research She is the Claiming Our Democracy Program Director at the Greenlining Institute, and Justin Rausa is the Health Program Manager for Greenlining's Bridges to Health team at the Greenlining Institute. And before the break, we were talking about Medi-Cal. And so, Justin, I'm wondering if we can kind of like continue that and kind of what did you find in terms of how things would change in regards to Medi-Cal for communities of color with this budget?
Right. The biggest change with Medi-Cal is going to be massive, and that's through the Medi-Cal expansion, which will start in 2014. As I alluded to earlier, the Affordable Care Act makes it optional for states to expand Medi-Cal, and Governor Brown, thankfully, has elected to move forward with that expansion, meaning that people who are between 101% and 138% of the federal poverty level will now be eligible for Medi-Cal, as well as adults without children who meet the income eligibility guidelines, they will also be eligible. Previously, you had to have dependents and also meet the income test to be eligible for Medi-Cal or have a disability. And now, you know, a working adult, but who is also very low income, can receive Medi-Cal healthcare benefits as well. And the reason why this is huge is because that will add essentially between 1.8 million and 2.7 million people across the state by 2019. 66% of these people are people of color. And this is a really big change because now people will have access to insurance and so can seek healthcare from those Medi-Cal providers in our state. And also, the nuance to the expansion, though, that the governor's proposed, he's saying, all right, either the state is going to handle the expansion, so all the administrative costs, the creation of, like, Medi-Cal provider networks, or he said the counties are going to take care of it. And so if we bring it back to the equity versus equality lens, we at the Greenlining Institute are really pushing for the state-based expansion. And the reason why is because in the first 3 years, 100% of the costs are funded by the federal government. And after that, starting 2020 and after, you know, it's going to decrease, but the most it'll decrease is up to 90%. So from 2020 onwards, the federal government will still fund 90% of the costs of Medi-Cal expansion. So the fiscal burden on the state is not as great, is not as large as some would like to make it out to be. And in terms of investments with equity, in the long run, it saves our state money because now people are not accessing healthcare through emergency rooms. They're not waiting until they're, you know, severely sick or on their deathbed before they actually try to access a doctor. It's earlier on because now they feel empowered. They do have health insurance through Medi-Cal and can access the doctors that way.
Okay, now joining us is Valerie Cuevas. She is Director of External Relations for the Education Trust West, a statewide education civil rights organization that works for the high academic achievement of all students by exposing opportunity and achievement gaps that separate students of color and low-income students from other youth. Valerie's expertise is in education equity, state legislative policy and K-12 governance, and she previously served as an aide to the chair of the California Assembly Committee on Higher Education and as chief of staff to a member of the Los Angeles Unified School District Board of Education. Welcome, Valerie.
Hi, Hannah. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to join you today.
Well, thank you for joining us. Let's start with what do you do? What is your work? What are you pushing for in education?
Well, we are a statewide policy research and advocacy organization that is focused on what are the ways that we create quality education experiences for all students. And we know that there are disproportionate impacts in terms of opportunity and achievement gaps that have historically impacted underserved students, primarily students of color, low-income students, English learners, all the groups of students that my colleagues from the Greenlining Institute have been talking about. And so our goal is to identify and expose those achievement gaps and then work around what are the solutions that will help us forever close those gaps so all our kids have access to the transformative power of education.
Mm. So you read the Greenlining Institute report, obviously. What do you make of some of the outcomes in terms of education and K through 12 and university funding?
Well, I can speak a little bit to university funding, but we'll primarily focus on K through 12. As you know, California as a whole, the total enrollment of our students is 6.2 million students in California. Our schools, our public schools, are serving a large majority of students of color. Just as my colleagues mentioned, we have 60% folks of color making up the new majority in California. Well, our schools are no different. Mm-hmm. The largest group of students being served by our public schools are, in fact, Latino students, just over 52% based on 2011-2012 numbers from the California Department of Education. So that means the schools today are serving students who are very different from the populations that were being served 30, 40 years ago. And yet, in many ways, the way we fund schools is quite archaic and is actually outdated. And I think that's part of what we see reflected in the governor's budget. So in terms of, just to give folks a perspective of what we're talking about 57% of our students in public schools today are considered low income. And so there's a tremendous need there in terms of what our schools are dealing with to address the needs of our changing demographics in our schools. In terms of English learners, there are 1.4 million English learners in our state, primarily hundreds of languages, but primarily Spanish is the language that most of our students bring to as an asset, a cultural asset, but we're trying to make sure that they are proficient and mastering academic English in ways that will help them fulfill their college and career dreams in the future. So those are tremendous needs in terms of what our schools look like today, and it's reflective of what my colleagues were saying, and that is that if we want to think about it, there are more Latino students in California alone than most states have total students. Mm. So that's a sense of how much of the impact is of the diversity of our the diversity that our students bring to our schools.
That's Valerie Cuevas of the Education Trust West. And we're going to go to your calls now. Let's take a caller, Donna in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to your call.
Hi there. I wanted to speak to higher education. Your speakers were talking about the UC and CSU systems. I neglected to talk about the largest community college system, which serves the population of minority students, Black, Latino, Asian students in the state. We are underfunded, under attack, and we provide the gateway to education for these populations. And I'd like to get your comments.
Okay. Thank you, Donna. Valerie, do you want to take that one? Community colleges.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, one of the things that we know is that for the future workforce of the state, there have been a number of studies that have demonstrated that we're going to need to have a larger percentage of folks completing college degrees or technical certificates. By the year 2025, at least 5.5 million new degrees and certificates will be needed. We know projection-wise, in terms of data, we're going to fall short by 2.3 million degrees. Now, in terms of K-12 and the pipeline in order to get to that goal, which is going to be vital to the state's economy, we actually need to accelerate student success along that pipeline. And we know that the community colleges are, in fact, the entry point for a number of students of color to eventually work their way through the degree completion. There are a number of organizations that are working to address this. And fortunately, as my colleagues mentioned, there's been a number of budget cuts that have adversely affected the ability of our institutions to be able to meet the demand and the need of our students completing at the community college level. But what we're talking about is really in what ways will we invest in these institutions for the sake of maintaining our quality of life in the future in the state of California.
Mm. And again, I'd like to give out our number, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255 if you'd like to call in with a comment or a question. Or you can shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to another caller. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to your call.
Yes, I would like to mention that The budgets so far have been developed with the premise of austerity, when in reality, and the media has contributed a lot to that as well, this idea of austerity, that somehow or another there is no money there. There is a lot of money here in California. This is a very, very rich state. The problem is the priorities. When I first arrived here in California when I was 17, back in 1979, that was just when Prop 13 was implemented. Up until then, the educational system here and everything that had to do with California was really a golden state. In other words, it was a state that provided a lot of services to people and it provided good education until Prop 13. And ever since then, everything has been going downhill because there hasn't been funding. And so just like the City College system, which is being under attack, which I am also a City College student, by the way, it's provided me with the ability to be able to gather my credits, for example, so that I can finally transfer throughout the different changes that you undergo in your life. It provides English language learners, like Valerie Cuera said, the ability to be able to, you know, pursue their educations. It provides people to get their GEDs, vocational training, all the different things that people need. It's being under attack, and it was shown with a show called letter. It was completely, it's been completely under attack, when in reality, the main reason why we, City College and a lot of the problems that are going on with the educational system is because the funding has been slashed time and time and time again. Millions and millions of dollars of funding have been slashed. Meanwhile, Bank of America gets a tax break of $666 million. I mean, we have to really start looking at our priorities. The Pacific Stock Exchange, for example, back in 1994, I remember there was a progressive tax proposal that was in front of the supervisors of San Francisco to tax the Pacific Stock Exchange just 0.5% of transactions over $1 million. That did not pass. That did not go through. But we have to start looking at all those different things because there is money there. We have to change our premise, basically.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lisa. I'll go straight to another call that kind of echoes that. Michael in San Francisco. Hi, Michael. Welcome to your call.
Hey, I just wanted to ask, I didn't hear Lisa's question, but mine is about the community colleges. How are they going to be served by this budget and then working towards next year's budget? I've seen at City College of San Francisco, my professor's pink slipped. I've seen departments that have been brought together and completely shrunk, and departments have disappeared every year since the 2 years I've been there. And I want to know, how are we going to move towards not only stopping the complete destruction of my school and the other community colleges, but I want to know what can we do towards building a better community college than community college system in California than what existed before.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Lots of concern about community colleges and City College in San Francisco. Michelle Romero of the Greenlining Institute, what do you say to Lisa and to Michael, who are concerned about the slashes to college funding, to community college funding? What did you see in your analysis that can possibly give them some comfort?
Yeah, I don't know if it'll, give comfort per se, but I think, they're right. Education is not the place to be cutting, right? I mean, and I think that we're going to continue to have real issues with the budget. Is there enough money until we're ready to have a serious conversation in this state about tax and budget reform? And revenue has to be on the table, right? But when it comes to higher education, we know that for every dollar the state invests in higher education, they return about $4 now in new jobs, new businesses, new research, higher incomes that those students are going to now make, and the taxes and purchasing power and all that kind of is attached to that. One of the ways that Governor Brown has proposed addressing the issue of higher education funding is to basically say, and so he recognizes, the community college system and the institutions themselves don't have the resources or capacity they need to serve the number of students who are seeking higher education, right? So in his proposal, he has allocated about $17 million to go to California community colleges and a little bit less to go to the other, to UC and CSU for the expansion of online classes. Now, we have some questions around this, right? Digital divide may come to mind for some, you know, who's really online? Will they be able, you know, will all students equally be able to access internet at home to take these courses? But I think even a deeper question than that is, who's going to be teaching these courses? If the issue is that there aren't enough resources to provide additional classes, is it just a facilities issue? You know, is it that there are not physically enough classrooms on campus? Then the online course proposal may work to serve that additional overflow. But if we're not also investing in additional instructors and, you know, resources for curriculum development and all of that, then we are concerned that it's just going to be more work with a little bit more resources, but, you know, not addressing the whole problem. And so there's still more to be done there. The good news is the January proposal. Yeah. The good news is the January proposal comes out, you know, as Governor Brown's first draft. And it almost never looks the same by the May revise. And so there is an opportunity to let your legislators know how you feel about it. And, you know, this is really the last chance for this year, right? Because we're already in April, coming on April. And so the May revise will come out mid-May. But there are budget hearings going on now, and legislators are all weighing in and negotiating these exact issues.
And will they be hearing the people?
That's a good question. I mean, it depends. Are you speaking loudly? I mean, I think they are. They are, especially some of the new legislators, I think, are really sensitive to their constituents. But if you think about it, everybody, even the incumbents, were affected by redistricting in the last election. And so they're all really interested in making sure they're serving their new constituents, right, as well. And so I think they are very sensitive to public input right now.
Okay, Valerie, would you like to comment on the you talked about the community colleges issue, but so what do you think is going to happen then in Sacramento in terms of education funding?
Well, I think this topic is very important. And when we think about funding for schools, let me set some context, and that is that California ranks 49th in per-pupil spending. So as much as we have a lot of money, we're still not spending as much as other states. As a matter of fact, we're 28% below the national average. We spend $8,482, close to that per student, and national average is $11,824. But when we look at school funding, we really need to look at it in terms of the money we have and the money that we want to have. So there's always going to be the need for more resource. We are a large state. We're serving a large number of students. We're going to need more dollars, and that's where the question of revenue generation comes into play and issues around Prop 13 and develop economic steam engines for the state and the like. But one of the things that's unique about this proposal, the governor's budget proposal this year, is that it addresses one of the issues that our organization has been working on for a number of years, and that is the notion that the way we currently fund California's schools, we find it to be fundamentally unfair, and particularly unfair to the populations of students of color and communities of color, English language learners, vulnerable populations that you talked about. The way we fund schools right now is relatively unfair because not only do we inadequately fund our schools, but we fail to equitably allocate the existing dollars that we do have. Some of our research found that in California's highest poverty districts, those with the largest concentrations of low-income students, on average, they're receiving $620 less per student from state and local sources versus what the state's wealthiest districts are spending per student. So therein alone is the context for what a problem is that the governor has, in fact, tried to address in this current budget. And by doing that, he's actually proposing a new way that we fund schools in California, particularly the way we fund districts, school districts. And what he's proposing is something that he's calling local control funding formula. Now, one of the things that's happening in Sacramento is that the unique aspects about this proposal itself is that what it will do is through it, every school district will, in fact, regardless of their location or student population, they won't lose money under this proposal. They'll actually receive more. So that's one of the promises that he's delivering on, which is more money for education. Now, it depends if you want to say more money than the past, given the cuts, then yes, it's more money. If you want to go back farther than what we used to spend, well, some people will say it's not more money. But the bottom line is, in terms of where we're at right now, it is a projection for more money. But what we're going to do is change the way that we actually target those dollars. And so districts that are actually serving larger percentages of English learners, larger percentages of low-income students, foster youth, different kinds of students that are what we find becoming the majority of our student populations will actually receive supplemental dollars on top of the base grant that every district will get per student. We'll get supplemental grants for those students. And then if you're a district in particular that is serving larger amounts of students who are in these categories, then you're going to get an additional concentration grant. Now, that's going to be something that is somewhat controversial and
it already is, yeah. reading a lot of kind of anti of that kind of a plan. So is there a chance that it might be changed, or, you know, will someone buckle under the pressure, or what do you see happening?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the bottom line for your listeners now, particularly if we're talking about from an equity lens, is we have found that this is the kind of funding mechanism that will ensure that is a student-centered funding mechanism that will meet the needs of students versus the way we fund now. The way we fund now, you can have districts that have the same kinds of students, but given the archaic, opaque, kind of confusing way we fund schools now, could be getting different amounts, dollar amounts from the state. And so what this is going to do is just going to make it more transparent and easier and actually prioritize that same set of students that I talked about earlier who are now comprising the majority of our state's, the majority of the students that our schools are serving. And it makes sense in that way, given what we talked about as you look along the pipeline, is that these are the same kids that we need entering higher education, whether through the community colleges, CSU, or UC, to drive that economic engine around degree completion and entrance into high-tech careers or whatever it might be that's going to maintain the quality of life for California.
And I'd like to invite our listeners again. We have a couple of minutes left. 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, if you'd like to get your call in or your comment or your question, or shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Valerie, what other education budget battles are you fighting up there in Sacramento as a part of your organization?
Well, one of the things that we recognize is that even through the governor's proposal now, we think that just the concept itself, and you'll find most folks up in Sacramento, legislators, whether they agree with it or not, say, yeah, that's a good idea. It fundamentally agrees with the governor's proposition that treating all students, treating those students who are unequal coming into the system equally is not fair, is not just, that we actually need to target more dollars towards student need to have equitable outcomes. And we agree with that. One of the things that's going to be important, though, is accountability around these dollars, because one of the unique aspects around the budget, the way it's being proposed now, is that in exchange for targeting these dollars, it will also mean more flexibility for districts to it'll free up categorical dollars that have historically had lots of different requirements about who they're spent on and how they're spent. And then it will also give more flexibility for those districts to control how they spend those dollars versus the state telling them. And that's kind of the give and take. Now, one of the things our organization is definitely working with legislators on, and the governor and anybody else in Sacramento and parents and communities, is we need to make sure that if we're going to fund our schools in a new way, that we're in fact spending the dollars on the students that are generating those dollars for those districts, and that we're actually making sure we're seeing the outcomes that we want related to that in terms of increased student achievement, closing opportunity gaps, making sure that in fact the students who need those dollars the most, that districts are in fact spending the dollars in ways that meet their needs.
Okay. Michelle, you know what? Sorry, let me go to Justin. We only have a few minutes left, but any final thoughts on your portion, kind of the health portion of the Greenlining Institute's report? What's the bottom line that you want people to know?
Well, the bottom line that we'd like people to know is that Medi-Cal expansion will benefit our state, and that the state should really take the mantle in implementing Medi-Cal expansion and not a county-based expansion for fiscal reasons, for equity reasons, and things like that. And the reason why this is important is because just like with education and with healthcare and Medi-Cal, these are a majority of people of color, and with our demographics in the state moving in that direction as well, these issues of funding different programs properly isn't just about an equity lens, but it's good business investment on the part of the state in terms of providing people with quality education, quality jobs, quality access to health care. Makes good business sense for the state, especially 5-10 years down the road from now, when these are the people who are working, who are teaching the younger generation, so on and so forth. So that is our bottom line, that with a focus on racial equity lens, hopefully it will help our state create better investments for our economy overall, for all Californians.
Michelle.
Yeah, I would just say racial equity is not a nice to do. I think it's necessary. We think it's necessary. And especially as the demographics continue to change, we've got to be able to talk about race. We've got to be able to pass policies like AB 411 that'll allow us to look at race and ethnicity data, language data, and these kinds of indicators to be able to identify the disparities and then target our dollars. Racial equity is really about taking chance out of the equation and spending smartly. So for our full report, folks can check out greenlining.org.
Thank you. Michelle Romero of the Greenlining Institute. With us also today was Justin Rausa from the Greenlining Institute as well. And Valerie Cuevas. Thank you, Valerie.
Well, thank you, Hannah. So
Director.
Much. I thank you for the time, and I encourage folks to learn more about the work that we're doing and to address what my colleagues were talking about. We're at www.edtrust.org.
Thank you very much. This is your call. I'm Hannah Baba. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Should plastic manufacturers be held responsible for plastic pollution? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about what corporate responsibility should look like for the plastics and packaging industry. Given the overwhelming amount of plastics that end up in the environment, what responsibility do the manufacturers have? Join us at 10 a.m. or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Do we need more legislation to hold corporations responsible? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.